Part 3, The Abyss. Chapter 1. She was standing on the Key Bridge walkway, arms atop the parapet, fidgeting, waiting, while homeward-bound traffic stuttered thickly behind her as drivers with everyday cares honked horns and bumpers nudged bumpers with scraping indifference. She had reached Mary Jo, told her lies.
Oh, yeah, Reagan's fine. By the way, I've been thinking of another little dinner party, Mary Jo. What was the name of that Jesuit psychiatrist again? I thought maybe I'd include him in.
Laughter floated up from below her. A blue-jeaned young couple in a rented canoe. With a quick, nervous gesture, she flicked ash from her cigarette, the last in her pack, and glanced up the walkway of the bridge toward the district. Someone hurrying toward her. Khaki pants, blue sweater. Not a priest. Not him. She looked down at the river again, at her helplessness swirling in the wake of the bright red canoe. She could make out the name on its side. Caprice. Footsteps. The man in the chinos and sweater coming closer, slowing down as he reached her. Peripherally, she saw him rest a forearm on the top of the parapet and quickly averted her gaze toward Virginia. Another autograph seeker, or worse, Chris McNeil. Flipping her cigarette butt into the river, Chris said coldly, "Keep moving or I swear I'll yell for a cop." "Miss McNeil, I'm Father Karras." Chris started, then reddened, jerking swiftly around to the chipped, rugged face. "Oh, my God, I'm so sorry." She was tugging at her sunglasses, flustered, then immediately pushing them back as the sad, dark eyes probed hers. "I should have told you that I wouldn't be in uniform." The voice was cradling, stripping her of burden. The priest had clasped his hands together on the parapet, veined Michelangelo's, sensitive and large. "I thought it would be much less conspicuous," he continued. "You seemed so concerned about keeping this quiet." "Guess I should have been concerned about not making such an ass of myself," Chris retorted. I just thought you were
human," Karras finished with a faint, wry smile.
Chris appraised him, and then, nodding and returning the smile, she said,
"Yeah, yeah. I knew that the first time I saw you."
"Oh, really? When was that?"
"On the campus one day while we were filming. You got a cigarette, Father?"
Karras reached into the pocket of his shirt. "Well, can you go a non-filter? Right now I'd smoke rope. On my allowance, I frequently do." Smiling tightly, Chris nodded. "You're right. Of poverty," she murmured, as she slipped out a cigarette from the packet the priest was holding out to her. Karras reached into a trouser pocket for matches.
"A vow of poverty has its uses," he said.
"Oh, really? Like what?"
"Makes rope taste better."
Again a half smile as he watched Chris's hand that was holding the cigarette. It was trembling, the cigarette wavering in quick, erratic jumps, and without pausing he took it from her fingers, put it up to his mouth, and, cupping his hands around the match, he lit the cigarette, puffed, and then gave it back to Chris, saying, "Awful lot of breeze from all these cars going by." Chris looked at him appraisingly, with gratitude, and even with hope. She knew what he'd done.
"Thanks, Father," she said.
And then she watched as he lit up a Camel for himself. He forgot to cup his hands. As he exhaled, they each leaned an elbow on the parapet.
"So, where are you from, Father Karras? I mean, originally."
"Oh, New York."
"Yeah? Oh, me too."
"I would never go back, though, would you?"
Karras fought down the rise in his throat.
"No. No, I wouldn't."
He forced a little smile. But I don't have to make those decisions. Chris shook her head and looked aside. God, I'm dumb, she said. You're a priest. Have to go where they send you. Yeah, that's right. Hey, how does Shrink ever get to be a priest? He was anxious to know what the urgent problem was that she'd mentioned when she'd called him at the residence. He was feeling her way, he sensed, but toward what? He must not prod. It would come. It's the other way around, he corrected her gently. The Society... Who? The Society of Jesus. Jesuit is short for that. Oh, I see. The Society sent me through medical school and through psychiatric training. Oh, really? Where? Oh, well, Harvard, Johns Hopkins, places like that. He was suddenly aware that he wanted to impress her. Why, he wondered, and immediately saw the answer in the slums of his boyhood, in the balconies of theaters on the Lower East Side, little Dimmy with the movie star. Chris nodded her head in approval. Not bad, she said. Yeah, we don't take vows of mental poverty. She sensed a subtle irritation, shrugged, turned front, facing out to the river. Look, it's just that I don't know you, and... She dragged on the cigarette, long and deep, then exhaled, crushing out the butt on the parapet, and then flipping it out to the river. You're a friend of Father Dyer, is that right? Yes, I am. Pretty close? Pretty close. Did he talk about my party? At your house? Yeah, at my house. Yeah, he said you seemed human. She missed it or ignored it. Did he talk about my daughter? No, I didn't know you had one. She's 12. He didn't mention her? No. He didn't tell you what she did? He never mentioned her. Priests keep a pretty tight mouth then, that right? Well, that depends, answered Karras. On what? On the priest. At the fringe of the Jesuit's awareness drifted a warning about women with neurotic attractions to priests, women who desired, unconsciously and under the guise of some other problem, to seduce the unattainable. Look, I mean like confession. You're not allowed to talk about it, right? Yeah, that's right. And outside of confession, she asked him. I mean, what if some, her hands were now agitated, fluttering. I'm curious. No, I'd really like to know. I mean, what if a person, let's say, was a criminal, like maybe a murderer or something, you know? If he came to you for help, would you have to turn him in? Let's see. Seeking instruction, he wondered. Was she clearing off doubts in the way of conversion? There were people, Karras knew, who approached salvation as if it were at the end of a flimsy bridge overhanging an abyss. Well, if he came to me for spiritual help, I'd say no, he answered. You wouldn't turn him in. No, I wouldn't. But I'd try to persuade him to turn himself in. Ah, and so, how do you go about getting an exorcism? There was a pause while Karras stared at her. I beg your pardon, he said at last. If a person's possessed by some kind of demon, how do you go about getting an exorcism? Karras looked off, took a breath, and looked back to her. Oh, well, first you'd have to put him in a time machine and get him back to the 16th century. Puzzled, Chris frowned. What do you mean? Well, it just doesn't happen anymore. Oh, really? Since when? Since when? Since we learned about mental illness and schizophrenia and split personality, all those things that they taught me at Harvard? Are you kidding me? Chris's voice had wavered, sounding helpless, confused, and instantly Karras regretted his flipness. Where had it come from, he wondered. It had leaped to his tongue unbidden. Many educated Catholics, he said in a gentler tone, don't believe in the devil anymore. And as far as possession is concerned, since the day I joined the Jesuits, I've never met a priest who's ever in his life performed an exorcism. Not one. Oh, are you really a priest, or are you from Central Casting? Chris blurted with a suddenly bitter, disappointed sharpness. I mean, what about all those stories in the Bible about Christ driving out all those demons? Karis answered spontaneously with heat. Look, if Christ had said those people who were supposedly possessed had schizophrenia, which I imagine they did, they would have probably crucified him 3 years earlier. Oh, really? Chris put a shaking hand to her sunglasses, deepening her voice in an effort at control. Well, it happens, Father Karis, that someone very close to me is probably possessed and needs an exorcism. Will you do it? To Karis, it suddenly seemed unreal. Key Bridge, motor traffic, across the river, the hot shop with frozen milkshakes, and beside him a movie star asking for an exorcism? As he stared at her, groping for an answer, she slipped off her oversized dark sunglasses, and Karis felt a wincing shock at the redness, at the desperate pleading in those haggard eyes, and suddenly realized that the woman was serious. Father Karis, it's my daughter. It's my daughter. Then all the more reason, he said to her soothingly, to forget about an exorcism. Why? Chris suddenly burst out in a voice that was cracking and strident and distraught. Tell me why? God, I don't understand. Karis took hold of her wrist in an effort to calm her. In the first place, he told her, it could make things worse. Incredulous, Chris scrunched up her face and said, worse? Yes, worse, that's right. Because the ritual of exorcism is dangerously suggestive. It could implant the notion of possession where it didn't exist before. Or if it did, it could tend to fortify it. And secondly, please, listen to me. Secondly, before the Catholic Church approves an exorcism, it conducts an investigation to see if it's warranted. And that takes time. In the meantime, couldn't you do it yourself? Chris's lower lip was slightly trembling now, her eyes filling up with tears. Look, every priest has the power to exorcise, but he has to have church approval. And frankly, it's rarely ever given, so can't you even look at her? Well, as a psychiatrist, I could. She needs a priest! Chris cried out suddenly, her features contorting with anger and fear. I've taken her to every goddamn fucking doctor psychiatrist in the world, and they sent me to you. Now you send me to them? Jesus Christ, won't somebody help me? The heart-stopping shriek bolted raw above the river, sending startled flocks of birds shooting up into the air from its grassy banks with the sound of cawing and a thousand flapping wings. Oh, my God. God, won't someone help me? Chris moaned, sobbing convulsively. She crumpled to Karis's chest. Oh, please, help me, please. The Jesuit looked down at her and then lifted up comforting hands to her head as the riders in traffic-locked automobiles glanced out windows to watch them with passing disinterest. It's all right, Karis told her. He wanted only to calm her, to stem her hysteria. My daughter? No, it was Chris who needed psychiatric help, he believed. It's all right. I'll go see her, he told her. I'll see her right now. Come on, let's go. With that sense of unreality still lingering, Karis let her lead him to the house in silence, and with thoughts of his next day's lecture at the Georgetown Medical School. He had yet to prepare his notes. As they climbed the front stoop, Karis glanced at his watch. It was 6:10. He looked down the street at the Jesuit residence hall as he realized he would now miss dinner. Father Karis, The priest turned to look at Chris. About to turn her key in the front door lock, she had hesitated and turned to him. "Do you think you should be wearing your priest clothes?" she said. Karis eyed her with a pity that he tried to conceal. Her face and her voice, how helplessly childlike they were. "Too dangerous," he told her. "Okay." Chris turned back and started opening the door. And it was then that Karis felt it. A chill, tugging warning. It scraped through his bloodstream like particles of ice. "Father Karis?" He looked up. Chris had entered the house. For a hesitant moment, the priest stood unmoving. Then, slowly and deliberately, as if he had made a decision to do so, he went forward, stepping into the house with an odd sense of ending. Karis heard commotion. Upstairs, a deep, booming voice was thundering obscenities, threatening in anger and in hate and frustration. Taken aback, he turned to Chris with a look of wonderment. She was staring at him mutely. Then she moved on ahead. He followed her upstairs and along a hall to where Carl was standing with his head bent low over folded arms, just opposite the door to Reagan's bedroom. At this close range, the voice from the bedroom was so loud that it almost seemed amplified electronically. As Carl looked up at their approach, the priest saw bafflement, fright in his eyes, as in an awed and cracking voice he said to Chris, "It wants no straps." Chris turned to Karis. "I'll be back in a second," she told him, the words coming dully from a worn-out soul. Karis watched her as she turned and walked away down the hall and then into her bedroom. She left the door wide open behind her. Karis turned his glance to Carl. The houseman was staring at him intently. "You a priest?" he asked. Karis nodded, then looked quickly back to Reagan's bedroom door. The raging voice had been abruptly displaced by the long, strident lowing of some animal that might have been a steer. Something prodding at Karis's hand. He looked down. "That's her," Chris was saying. "That's Reagan." She was handing him a photograph, and he took it. A young girl. Very pretty. Sweet smile. "That was taken 4 months ago," Chris said dreamily. She took back the photo and motioned with her head at the bedroom door. "Now you go and take a look at her now." Chris leaned back against the wall beside Carl. With her eyes cast down, her arms folded across her chest, she said hopelessly and quietly, "I'll wait here." "Who's in there with her?" Karis asked. Chris looked up at him, expressionless. "No one." The priest held her haunted gaze and then turned with a frown to the bedroom door. And as he grasped the doorknob, the sounds from within abruptly ceased. In the ticking silence, Karis hesitated, then slowly entered the room, almost flinching backward at the pungent stench of moldering excrement that hit his face and his nostrils like a palpable blast. Reining in his revulsion, he closed the door, and then his eyes locked, stunned, on the thing that was Reagan, on the creature that was lying on its back on the bed, head propped against a pillow, while eyes bulging wide in their hollow sockets shone with mad cunning and burning intelligence, with interest and with spite, as they fixed upon his, as they watched him intently, seething in a face shaped into a skeletal mask of unthinkable malevolence. Karis shifted his gaze to the tangled and thickly matted hair to the wasted arms and legs and distended stomach jutting up so grotesquely. Then back to the eyes. They were watching him, pinning him, shifting now to follow as he moved to a desk and chair near the large bay window. Karis fought to sound calm, even warm and friendly. "Hello, Reagan," he said. He picked up the chair and took it over by the bed. "I'm a friend of your mother's," he said, "and she tells me that you're very, very sick." Karis sat down. "Do you think you'd like to tell me what's wrong?" he asked. "I'd like to help you." Reagan's eyes gleamed fiercely, unblinking, as the yellowish saliva dribbled down from a corner of her mouth to her chin, to her lips stretched taut into a feral grin of bow-mouthed mockery. "Well, well, well," she gloated sardonically, and hairs prickled up on the back of Karis's neck at a voice that was deep and thick with menace and power. "So it's you. They sent you," she continued as if pleased. "Well, we've nothing to fear from you at all." "Yes, yes, that's right," Karis answered. "I'm your friend. I told you I'm your mother's friend. And I would like to help you." "Well, you might loosen these straps then," Reagan croaked. She had tugged up her wrists so that now Karis noticed they were bound with a double set of leather restraining straps.
"Are the straps uncomfortable for you?"
"Yes, extremely. They're a nuisance, an infernal nuisance." The eyes glinted slyly with secret amusement. Karis saw the scratch marks on Reagan's face, the cuts on her lips where apparently she'd bitten them. I'm afraid you might hurt yourself, Reagan," he told her. "I'm not Reagan," she rumbled, still with that taut and hideous grin that Karis now guessed was a permanent expression. How incongruous the braces on her teeth looked. "Oh, I see," he said, nodding. "Well, then, maybe we should introduce ourselves. I'm Damien Karis. Who are you?" "I'm the devil."
"Oh, good,"
Karis nodded approvingly. "Now we can talk." "Oh, a little chat?"
"Oh,
if you wish." "Oh, yes, I would like that," Reagan said, drooling a little from a corner of her mouth. "However, you'll find that I cannot talk freely while bound with these straps. As you know, I've spent much of my time in Rome, and I'm accustomed to gesturing, Karis. Now then, kindly undo the strap." What precocity of language and thought, reflected Karis. He leaned forward in his chair with a mixture of amazement and professional interest. "You say you're the devil?" he asked.
"I assure you."
"Well then, why don't you just make the straps disappear?"
"Oh, come, that's much too vulgar a display of power, Karis. After all, I'm a prince. The prince of this world, as some very strange person said of me once. Can't remember quite who." "I much prefer persuasion, Karis. Togetherness, community, involvement. Moreover, if I loosen the straps myself, I deny you the opportunity of performing a charitable act." "Incredible," thought Karis. "But a charitable act," he parried, "is a virtue, and that's what the devil would want to prevent. So, in fact, I'd be helping you now if I didn't undo the straps. Oh, well, I mean, unless, of course," Karis shrugged, "unless, of course, you really aren't the devil, and that case, I probably would undo them."
"How very foxy of you, Karis. If only dear Herod were here to enjoy this. Karis stared with narrowed eyes and an even deeper interest. Was she punning on Christ's calling Herod that fox? Which Herod, he asked. There were two. Are you talking about the king of Judea?
No, I am talking about the Tetrarch of Galilee!
Regan shot back at Karis, and a voice raised to blast him with scorching contempt. Then abruptly she was grinning again, as she quietly cajoled in that soft and sinister voice.
There you see how these damnable straps have upset me. Undo them, Karis.
Undo them, and I'll tell you the future.
That's very tempting. Huh? My forte.
Yeah, but how do I know you really can read the future?
Because I'm the devil, you ass. Yes, you say so.
But you won't give me proof.
You have no faith.
Karis stiffened, paused. No faith in what?
Why, in me, my dear Karis. In me.
Something mocking and malicious danced hidden in those eyes.
All these proofs. All these signs in the sky.
Karis barely had a grip on his composure as he answered,
Well, now something very simple might do. For example, the devil knows everything, right?
No. In fact, I know almost everything, Karis.
There you see, they keep saying that I am proud.
I'm not.
Now then, what are you up to, sly fox? Spit it out.
Well, I thought we might test the extent of your knowledge.
Very well, then. How's this? The largest lake in South America, the Reagan thing japed, her eyes bulging with mocking glee, is Lake Titicaca in Peru. Will that do it?
No. I'll have to ask something only the devil would know.
Ah, I see. Such as what?
Well, where is Reagan?
She is here.
Where is here?
In the piglet.
Well, then let me see her.
Why, Karis? Do you want to fuck her?
Loose these straps and I'll let you go at it.
I want to see if you're telling me the truth. Let me see her. She's a poor conversationalist, my friend. I strongly advise you to stay with me.
Well, it's obvious to me you don't know where she is. Karis shrugged. So, apparently you aren't the devil.
I am!
Well, then let me see Reagan. I mean, that would prove it.
There are much better ways. I will show you. I will read your mind. The Reagan creature seethed furiously. Think of a number between 1 and 100.
Come on, that wouldn't prove a thing. I'd have to see Reagan. Abruptly, it chuckled, leaning back against the headboard.
No. No, nothing would prove anything at all to you, Karis. That is why I love all reasonable men. Oh, how splendid indeed. In the meantime, we shall try to keep you properly beguiled. After all, we wouldn't wish to lose you.
Who is we? Karis probed with a quick, alert interest.
Oh, we are quite a little group in the piglet, came the answer. Oh, yes. Quite a little multitude. Later I may see about discreet introductions. In the meantime, I am suffering from a maddening itch that I cannot reach. Would you loosen one strap for a moment? Just one.
No. Just tell me where it itches and I'll scratch it.
Sly. Very, very sly.
Listen, let's quit kidding around. You show me Reagan, and Perhaps I'll undo one strap, offered Karis. I mean, that's for fighting, she's...
Abruptly, the priest flinched in shock as he found himself staring into eyes filled with terror and a mouth gaping wide and a soundless shriek for help. But then quickly the Reagan identity vanished in a blurringly rapid remolding of features as,
For pity's sakes, would you kindly remove these cunting straps?
Asked the wheedling voice in a clipped British accent, just before, in a flash, the demonic personality returned.
Could you help an old altar boy, Father? It croaked, and as it threw back its head in wild and high-pitched laughter.
Stunned, Karis leaned back as he felt the glacial hands at the back of his neck again, more palpable now and more clearly something more than suggestion. The Reagan thing broke off its laughter and fixed him with taunting eyes.
Feeling icy hands, Karis?
Oh, incidentally, your mother is in here with us, Karis. Would you like to leave a message?
I'll see that she gets it.
Mocking laughter, and then suddenly Karis was leaping out of his chair as he dodged a projectile stream of vomit. It caught a portion of a sweater and one of his hands. His face drained of color, the priest looked down at the bed, at Reagan cackling with glee as his hand dripped vomit onto the rug.
If that's true, he said numbly, then you must know my mother's first name.
Oh, I do.
Well, what is it?
The Reagan thing hissed at him, mad eyes gleaming, and the head gently undulating from side to side like a cobra's.
What is it? Karis repeated,
with her eyes rolling upward into their sockets. Reagan lowed like a steer in an angry bellow that pierced the shutters and shivered through the glass of the large bay window. For a time, Karis watched as the bellowing continued. Then he looked at his hand and walked out of the room. Chris pushed herself quickly away from the wall as she glanced with distress at the Jesuit sweater.
Oh, what happened? Oh, God, did she vomit?
You got a towel? Karis asked her. There's a bathroom right there, Chris said hurriedly, pointing at a hallway door.
Carl, go and take a look at her, she instructed over her shoulder as she followed the priest to the bathroom.
I'm so sorry. The Jesuit moved to the wash basin. Have you got her on tranquilizers? He asked.
Chris turned on the water taps and answered, Yes, yes, Librium.
Here, take that sweater off, and then you can wash. What dosage? Karis asked, as he tugged at the sweater with his clean left hand.
And wait a second, I'll help you.
Chris pulled at the sweater from the bottom. Well, today she's had 400 milligrams, Father.
400?
Chris had the sweater pulled up to his chest.
Yeah, that's how we got her into those straps.
It took all of us together.
You gave your daughter 400 milligrams at once?
Father, she's so strong you can't believe it. Get your arms up, please.
Okay.
He raised them and Chris pulled the sweater up and off, pulled back the shower curtain and tossed the sweater into the bathtub. I'll have Willie get it clean for you, Father. She dejectedly sat down on the edge of the bathtub and slipped a pink towel off a towel bar, her hand inadvertently covering the word Reagan, embroidered in navy blue script.
I'm just so sorry, she said.
Never mind, doesn't matter. Karis unbuttoned the right sleeve of his starched white shirt and rolled it up, exposing a matting of fine brown hairs on the thickly muscled forearm, as he asked, is she taking any nourishment at all? He held his hand underneath the hot water tap to rinse away the vomit.
No, Father. The sausage, I mean, when she's sleeping, but she ripped out the tubing.
She ripped it out? When?
Today.
Disturbed, Karras soaped and rinsed his hands, and after a thoughtful pause, he said gravely, "You know, your daughter really needs to be in a hospital." Chris lowered her head. "I just can't do that, Father," she said, in a soft, flat, toneless voice. "Why can't you?" "I just can't," Chris repeated, in a husky, dead whisper. She's done something, Father, and I can't take the risk of someone else finding out. Not a doctor, not a nurse, not anyone." Frowning, Karras turned off the water taps and recollected. "What if a person, let's say, was a criminal?" Troubled, he looked down at the wash basin, gripping its sides. "Who's been giving her the sustagen, the Librium, or medicines?" "We are. Her doctor showed us how." "Well, you need prescriptions." "But you could do some of that, couldn't you, Father?" His thoughts now spinning, Karras turned to her, his hands upraised, as he met Chris's haunted, vanquished gaze. He nodded toward the towel in her hands and said, "Please." Chris stared at him blankly and said, "What? Towel, please? I'm sorry." Very quickly, Chris fumbled it out to him. And as the Jesuit dried his hands, she asked him with a tightly searching expectancy, "So now, Father, what's it look like? Do you think she's possessed?" "Look, how much do you know about possession?" "I don't know. Just a little that I've read and some things that some doctors told me." "Doctors? What doctors?" "At Barringer Clinic." "I see." Karras nodded his head. He had folded the towel and was carefully draping it back onto the towel bar as he asked, "Miss McNeil, are you a Catholic?" "No, no, I'm not." "And your daughter?" "No, not her either." "Well, what religion then?" "None." Karras stared at her speculatively. "Why did you come to me then?"
"Because I was desperate," Chris blurted in a quavering voice.
"I thought you told me psychiatrists advised you to come to me."
"Oh, I don't know what I was saying. I've been practically out of my head."
Karras turned and, folding his arms and leaning his weight against the wash basin's white marble counter, he looked down at Chris and told her with a carefully tempered intensity,
"Look, the only thing I care about is doing what's best for your daughter. But I'll tell you right now that if you're looking for an exorcism as an autosuggestive cure, you'd have been much better off if you had gone to Central Casting, Miss McNeil, because Catholic Church authorities aren't going to buy it, and you'll have wasted precious time." Karras felt his hands trembling slightly. "What's wrong with me?" he wondered. "What's happening?" "Incidentally, it's Mrs. McNeil," Chris corrected him tautly. Karras gentled his tone.
"My apology. Look, whether it's a demon or a mental disorder, I'll do everything I possibly can to help your daughter. But I have got to have the truth, the whole truth. It's important. It's important for Reagan, Mrs. McNeil, because right now I'm groping. I'm completely overwhelmed by what I've just seen and heard in your daughter's bedroom. Now, can we both get out of this bathroom and go downstairs where we can really talk?" With a faint, warm smile of reassurance, Karras reached out his hand to help Chris up.
"I could really use a good cup of coffee. I could really use a sea and ski on the rocks."
While Carl and Sharon looked after Reagan, Karras and Chris sat in the study, she on the sofa and Karras in a chair beside the fireplace. As Chris went through the history of Reagan's illness, though she carefully withheld any mention of phenomena relating to Dennings. The priest listened, saying little, an occasional question, a nod, or frown, as Chris admitted that at first she'd considered an exorcism as shock treatment. But now, how, I don't know. I don't know, she said. Shaking her head, she looked down at her freckled, clasped fingers, subtly twitching in her lap. Father, I don't know. She lifted a helpless look to the priest. What do you think, Father? Lowering his head, the priest took in a breath, shook his head, and said quietly, I don't know either. Compulsive behavior produced by guilt, perhaps? Put together with split personality?
What?
Chris looked appalled.
Father, how can you say that? After all you've just seen up there.
Karis looked up at her. If you've seen as many patients in psychiatric wards as I have, you can say it very easily, he said. Come on now. Possession by demons? Okay, listen. Let's assume it's a fact and that it sometimes happens. But your daughter doesn't say she's a demon. She insists she's the devil himself. That's the same thing as saying you're Napoleon Bonaparte. Okay. Okay, then explain all those rappings and things. I haven't heard them. Well, they heard them at Barringer, Father, so it wasn't just here in the house. Maybe so, but we'd hardly need a devil to explain them. Oh, really? So explain them. Well, psychokinesis, maybe.
What?
Well, you've heard of poltergeist phenomena, haven't you? Ghosts throwing dishes and acting like assholes? It's not that uncommon and usually happens around an emotionally disturbed adolescent. Apparently, extreme inattention of the mind can sometimes trigger some unknown energy that seems to move objects around at a distance. But there's nothing supernatural about it. Same with Reagan's abnormal strength, a pathology that's common. Call it mind over matter if you like, but it happens outside of possession. Chris looked away, slightly shaking her head. Boy, isn't this beautiful, she said with weary irony. Here I am, the atheist, and here you are, a priest. And the best explanation for any phenomenon, Karis gently told her, is always the simplest one available that accommodates all the facts. Oh, really? Chris retorted, in her red-veined eyes a look of pleading and despair and confusion. Oh, well, maybe I'm dumb, Father Karis. But telling me some unknown gizmo in somebody's head throw dishes at a wall seems to me even dumber. So what is it? Can you tell me what it is? And what split personality, anyway? I mean, you say it. I hear it. What the fuck is it? Am I really that stupid? Will you tell me what the fuck it is in a way that I can finally get it through my head? Look, there's no one who pretends to understand it. All we know is that it happens, and anything beyond the phenomenon itself is just pure speculation. It's guesswork. But think of it this way, if you like. Yeah? Go ahead. The human brain contains something like 17 billion cells, and when we look at them, we see that they handle approximately 100 million sensations that are bombarding your brain every second. And your brain not only integrates all of those messages, they do it efficiently, they do it without ever stumbling or getting in each other's way. Now then, how could they do that without some form of communication? Well, they couldn't. So apparently, each of these cells has a consciousness, maybe, of its own. Are you still with me? Chris nodded. Yeah? A little? Good. Now imagine that the human body is a gigantic ocean liner, and that all of your brain cells are the crew. Now one of these crew cells is up on the bridge, okay? He's the captain. But he never knows precisely what the rest of the crew below decks is doing. All he knows is that the ship keeps running smoothly and the job's getting done. Now the captain is you. I mean, it's your waking consciousness. And what happens in dual personality, I mean, maybe, is that one of those crew cells down below decks comes up on the bridge and takes over command of the ship. In other words, mutiny. Does that help you to understand it? Chris was staring in unblinking incredulity. Father, that's so far out of sight that I think it's almost easier to believe in the fucking devil. Well, I don't know about all of these theories and stuff, Chris overrode him in a low, intense voice. But I want to tell you something, Father. You show me Reagan's identical twin. Same face, same voice, same smell, same everything down to the way she dots her eyes. And still I'd know in a second that it wasn't really her. I just know it. I'd know it in my gut. And I'm telling you, that thing upstairs is not my daughter. Now you tell me what to do, she said, her voice slowly rising and quivering with tightly held emotion. You tell me that you know for a fact there's nothing wrong with my daughter except in her head, that you know for a fact that she doesn't need an exorcism, and that you're absolutely sure it wouldn't help her. You go ahead. You tell me that, Father. You tell me that! At the end, it was a scream. Karis looked aside, and for long, pensive seconds, he was still. Then he turned a probing glance back to Chris. In the normal state, does she have a low-pitched voice? He asked her quietly. Normally. No, in fact, I'd say it's very light. Would you consider her precocious? Not at all. Her IQ? Above average. Reading habits. Nancy Drew and comic books mostly. And her style of speech right now. How much different would you say it is from normal? Well, completely. She's never used half of those words. No, I don't mean the content of a speech. I mean the style. The style. The way she puts words together. Chris's eyebrows lowered. Sorry, I'm still not really sure what you mean. Do you have any letters she's written, compositions? Recording of her voice, of course. Yes, there is a tape of her talking to her father. She was making it to send him as a letter, but she never got it finished. You want it? Yes, I do. And I'll also need her medical records, especially the file from Barringer. Chris looked aside and shook her head. Oh, Father, I've been that rude, and yes, I know. I really have to see the records for myself. So you're still against an exorcism? No, I'm only against the chance of doing your daughter more harm than good. But you're talking now strictly as a psychiatrist, right? No, I'm talking now also as a priest. If I go to the chancery office, or wherever it is I have to go to get permission for an exorcism, the first thing I'd have to have is a pretty substantial indication that your daughter's condition isn't a purely psychiatric problem, plus evidence that the church would accept as signs of possession. Well, like what? I don't know. Have to just go and look it up. Are you kidding me? I thought you were supposed to be an expert. There aren't any experts. You probably know more about demonic possession right now than most priests. Now listen, let's get serious. How soon can you get those Barringer records? I'll charter a plane, Father, if I have to. And that tape?
Chris stood up. I'll go see if I can find it. Oh,
just one other thing.
Yeah, what?
That book you mentioned with the section on possession. You think you can remember now if Reagan might have read it prior to the onset of the illness? Looking down, Chris concentrated.
Gee, I seem to remember her reading something the day before before the trouble really started.
But I can't be sure. But she did read it, I think. I mean, I'm sure. I'm pretty sure.
I'd like to see it.
Chris started away.
Sure, I'll get it for you, Father.
And the tape, it's in the basement, I think. I'll go and look. Karis nodded absently, staring at a pattern in an oriental area rug. And then after many minutes, he got up and walked slowly to the entry hall where, with his hands in the pockets of his trousers, he stood motionless in the darkness, as if in some other dimension, as he listened to the grunting of a pig from upstairs, then the yelping of a jackal, and then hiccuping, and snake-like hissing.
Oh, you're there. I went looking for you in the study.
Karis turned to see Chris flicking on the entry hall lights.
Are you leaving, Father? She asked, as she came forward with the witchcraft book and Reagan's tape-recorded letter to her father.
I'm afraid I've got to. I've got a lecture to prepare for tomorrow.
Really? Where?
At the med school, Karis answered, accepting the book and the tape from Chris's hands.
I'll try to get here sometime tomorrow morning or evening.
In the meantime, if anything urgent develops, you be sure you call me, no matter what time. I'll leave word at the switchboard to let you ring through, okay?
Now listen, how are you fixed for medication?
We're okay, we're there. They're all on refillable prescriptions.
You won't call your doctor in again?
The actress lowered her head.
I can't, she said barely above a whisper. I just can't.
You know I'm not a GP, Karis cautioned her.
I know.
It's okay. Chris still hadn't looked up, and Karis studied her intently and with concern. He could almost hear her anxiety pulsing and throbbing. Well, now, sooner or later, he said to her gently, I'm going to have to tell one of my superiors what I'm up to, most especially if I'm going to be coming by here at various unusual hours of the night.
Chris looked up at him, worriedly frowning.
Do you have to? I mean, tell them? Well, if I don't you think it might look a bit odd?
Chris looked down again, nodding.
Oh, yeah. I see what you mean.
Do you mind?
I'll tell them only what I have to. And don't worry, it's not going to get around.
Chris lifted a helpless, tormented face to the strong, sad eyes, saw the strength, saw the pain.
Okay, she said weakly. She trusted the pain. We'll be talking, Karis told her.
He started outside, but then hung in the doorway, head down with the back of a fist to his lips as if thinking. And then he looked up at Chris.
Did your daughter know a priest was coming over here tonight?
No, nobody knew but me.
Did you know that my mother had died just recently?
Yes, I'm very sorry.
Is Reagan aware of it?
Why?
Is she aware of it?
No, not at all.
Why do you ask?
Karis shrugged.
It's not important, he said. I just wondered. He examined Chris's features with a faint look of worry.
Are you getting any sleep?
Oh, well, some.
Get pills then, Chris.
Are you taking any Librium?
Yes.
How much? 10 milligrams twice a day?
Make it 20.
In the meantime, try to keep away from your daughter. The more you're exposed to her present behavior, the greater the chance of some permanent damage being done to your feelings about her. Stay clear, please, and slow down. You'd be no help to Reagan with a nervous breakdown. Her head and eyes lowered. Chris nodded despondently. "Now go to bed," Karis told her. "Will you please go to bed right now?" "Yeah, okay," Chris said softly. "I promise." She looked up at him with warmth and the trace of a smile. "Good night, Father Karis. And thanks. Thanks so much." For a moment, Karis studied her clinically again, then said, "Okay now. Good night." And then turning, he moved quickly away. Chris stood watching from the doorway. As he crossed the street, it occurred to her that he'd probably missed his dinner, and then she worried that he might be cold. He was rolling his shirt sleeve down. As he passed the 1789 restaurant, he dropped something, possibly the witchcraft book or the tape of Reagan's voice. He stooped to retrieve it, and at the corner of 36th Street and P, he turned left and vanished from her sight. Chris abruptly was aware of a feeling of lightness. She didn't see Kinderman sitting alone in an unmarked car. Half an hour later, Damien Karis hurried back to his room in the Jesuit residence hall with a number of books and periodicals taken from the shelves of the Georgetown campus library. Hastily, he dumped them on top of his desk and then rummaged through drawers for a package of cigarettes, and then, finding a half-empty pack of stale Camels, he lit one, drew on it deeply, and held the smoke in his lungs as his mind went to Reagan. Hysteria, he thought. That had to be it. He exhaled the smoke, hooked his thumbs in his belt, and looked down at the books. He had Osterreich's Possession, Huxley's The Devils of Loudun, Parapraxis in the Heisman case of Sigmund Freud, McCaslin's Demon Possession and Exorcism in Early Christianity in the Light of Modern Views of Mental Illness, and extracts from psychiatric journals of Freud's A Neurosis of Demoniacal Possession in the 17th Century, and finally, The Demonology of Modern Psychiatry.
"Could you open old altar boy, Father?"
The Jesuit felt at his brow and then looked at sticky sweat on his fingers. Then he noticed that he'd left his door open. He crossed the room and closed it, and then went to a shelf for his red-bound copy of The Roman Ritual, a compendium of rites and prayers. Clamping the cigarette between his lips, he squinted through smoke as he turned to the general rules for exorcists, looking for the signs of demonic possession. He first skimmed it, and then started to read more slowly. "The exorcist should not believe too readily that a person is possessed by an evil spirit, but he ought to ascertain the signs by which a person possessed can be distinguished from one who is suffering from some illness, especially one of a psychological nature. Signs of possession may be the following: ability to speak with some facility in a strange language, or to understand it when spoken by another, the faculty of divulging future and hidden events, display of powers which are beyond the subject's age and natural condition, and various other conditions which, when taken together as a whole, build up the evidence." For a time, Karis pondered. Then he leaned against the bookshelf and read the remainder of the instructions. When he had finished, he found himself glancing back up at instruction number 8. "Some reveal a crime which has been committed." A light knocking at the door. "Damien?" Karis looked up and said, "Come on in." It was Dyer. "Hey, Chris McNeil has been trying to reach you," he said as he entered the room. "Did she ever get hold of you?" "When? You mean tonight?" No, this early afternoon." "Oh, yeah, Joe. Thanks. Yes, I spoke to her." "Oh, good. I just wanted to be sure you got the message." The pixie-ish priest was prowling the room as if searching for something. "What do you need, Joe?" Karis asked. "Got any lemon drops, Damien? I've looked all through the hall, but nobody's got any, and man, do I crave one, maybe two," Dyer broodingly uttered, still prowling. "You know, I once spent a year hearing children's confessions, and I wound up a lemon drop junkie.
The little shitheads keep breathing it on you along with all that pot. Between the two have come to think it's addictive. Dyer lifted the lid of a pipe tobacco humidor, half filled with pistachio nuts. What are these, he asked. Dead Mexican jumping beans? Karras turned to his bookshelves, looking for a title. Listen, Joe, I'm sort of busy right now. Hey, isn't that Chris really nice, interrupted Dyer, flopping down on Karras's cot and stretching out full length with his hands clasped comfortably behind his head. Neat lady. Have you met her? I mean, you know, seen her in person? We've talked, answered Karras, as he plucked out a green-bound volume titled Satan, a collection of articles and Catholic position papers by various French theologians. He carried it back with him toward his desk. Now then, plain, you know, down to earth, unaffected, Dyer ruminated obliviously while staring up at the room's high ceiling. She can help us with my plan for when we both quit the priesthood, Dimmy. Karras looked at Dyer sharply. Who's quitting the priesthood? Gays, in droves. Basic black has gone out. Karras shook his head in bemused disapproval as he set down the books on his desk. Hey, come on, Joe, Karras chided him. Take her to some lounge act in Vegas, will you? Come on, scoot. Got a lecture to prepare for tomorrow. No, wait now. First we go to Chris McNeil, the young priest persisted, with this notion that I've got for a screenplay based on the life of St. Ignatius Loyola that for now I'm calling Brave Jesuits Marching. Tamping out his cigarette in an ashtray, Karras lifted his head to Dyer with a scowl. Would you get your ass out of here, Joe? I've got some heavy work to do. So who's stopping you? You. Karras had started to unbutton his shirt. I'm going to jump in the shower now, and when I come back in here, I expect you to be gone, Joe. Oh, well, grumbled Dyer reluctantly as he rose and swung his legs around so that he was sitting on the side of the bed. I didn't see you at dinner, by the way. Where'd you eat? I didn't. That's foolish. Why diet when you wear only frocks? Is there a tape recorder here in the hall, Joe? There isn't even a lemon drop here in the hall. Use the language lab. Who's got a key, Joe? Father President? No, Father Janitor. You need it for tonight? Yes, I do, Karras answered as he draped his shirt on the back of his desk chair. Where do I find him? Want me to get it for you, Damien? Oh, would you, Joe? I'm really in a bind. Dyer stood up. No sweat? Karras showered and then dressed in a t-shirt and trousers. Sitting down at his desk, he discovered a carton of Camel non-filters, and beside it a key that was labeled Language Lab, and another tagged Refectory Refrigerator. Appended to the latter was a note. Better you than the rats and Dominican cat burglars. Karras smiled at the signature. The lemon-drop kid. He put the note aside, then unfastened his wristwatch and placed it in front of him on the desk. The time was 10:58 p.m. Karras read, first Freud, then McCaslin, parts of Satan, parts of Osterreich's exhaustive study, and at a little after 4 a.m., he had finished reading and was rubbing at his face and at his eyes. They were smarting, and smoke was hanging thick in the air, while the ashtray on Karras's desk was mounded high with ashes and the twisted butts of cigarettes. He stood up and walked wearily to a window, slid it open, gulped in the coolness of moist early morning air, and then stood there thinking about Reagan. Yes, she had the physical syndrome of possession. About that he had no doubt. In case after case, irrespective of geography or period of history, the symptoms of possession were substantially a constant. Some of them Reagan had not evidenced as yet. Stigmata, or the desire for repugnant foods, or insensitivity to pain, as well as frequently loud and irrepressible hiccuping. But some others she had clearly manifested. The involuntary motor excitement, foul breath, furred
tongue, the wasting away of the bodily frame, the distended stomach, the irritations of the skin and mucous membrane, and most significantly present were the basic symptoms of the hard core of cases that Oesterreich has characterized as genuine possession. The striking change in the voice and in the features, plus the manifestation of a new personality. Through the window, Kara stared darkly up the street. Through the branches of trees, he could see the McNeil house and the large bay window of Reagan's bedroom. From his readings, he had learned that when possession was voluntary, as with mediums, the new personality was often benign. Like Tia, Karras brooded. The spirit of a woman who possessed a man, a sculptor, intermittently and for only an hour or so at a time, until a friend of the sculptor fell desperately in love with Tia and pleaded with the sculptor to permit her to permanently remain in possession of his body. But in Reagan there's no Tia, the priest reflected grimly, for the seemingly invading personality was malevolent and typical of cases of demonic possession, where the new personality sought the destruction of the body of its host, and frequently achieved it. Moodily, the Jesuit walked back to his desk, picked up a package of cigarettes and lit one. So, okay, she's got the physical syndrome of possession, he thought. Now, how do you cure it? He fanned out the match. Well, that depends on what caused it. He sat on the edge of his desk and reflected on the case of the nuns at the convent of Lille in early 17th century France. Allegedly possessed, they had confessed to their exorcists that while helpless in the state of possession, they had regularly attended satanic orgies at which they had varied their erotic fare. Mondays and Tuesdays, heterosexual copulation. Thursdays, sodomy, fellatio, and cunnilingus with homosexual partners. Saturday, bestiality with domestic animals and dragons. And dragons? The Jesuit ruefully shook his head. As with Lille, he thought the causes of many possessions, perhaps most, were a mixture of fraud and mythomania, with still others caused by mental illness, paranoia, schizophrenia, neurasthenia, psychasthenia. And this was the reason, he knew, that the church had for years recommended that the exorcist work with a psychiatrist or neurologist present during the rite. Yet not every possession had a cause so clear. Many had led Oesterreich to characterize possession as a separate disorder all its own, to dismiss the explanatory split personality label of psychiatry as no more than an equally occult substitution for the concepts demon and spirit of the dead. Karras rubbed the side of an index finger in the crease beside his nose. The indications from Barringer, Chris had told him, were that Reagan's disorder might be caused by suggestion, by something that was somehow related to hysteria. And Karras thought it likely so. He believed the majority of the cases he had studied had been caused by precisely these two factors. For one thing, it mostly hits women. For another, all those outbreaks of possession epidemics. And then those exorcists. Karras frowned. The exorcists themselves at times became the victims of possession, as had happened in 1634 at the Ursuline Convent of Nuns at Loudun, France. Of the four Jesuit exorcists sent there to deal with an epidemic of possession, three, Fathers Lucas, Lactance, and Tranquille, not only became seemingly possessed, but died soon after of apparent cardiac arrest caused by unrelenting hyper-psychomotor activity. The constant cursing and the bellowing in rage, the unceasing fits of thrashing about in their beds, while the fourth, Père Sorin, who at the time of the possession was 33 years of age and one of Europe's foremost intellectuals, became insane and was sequestered in a mental institution for the subsequent 25 years of his life. Karras brutally nodded. If Reagan's disorder was rooted in hysteria and the onset of the symptoms of possession was the product of suggestion, then the only likely source of the suggestion was the chapter on possession in the witchcraft book. He pored over its pages. Had Reagan read it? Were there striking similarities between any of its details and Reagan's behavior? He found some correlations. The case of an 8-year-old girl who was described in the chapter as bellowing like a bull in a thunderous, deep bass voice. Reagan lowing like a steer. The case of Helene Smith, who'd been treated by the great psychologist Flournoy. His description of the changing of her voice and her features with lightning rapidity into those of a variety of personalities. She did that with me, the personality who spoke with a British accent. Quick change, instantaneous. A case in South Africa, reported firsthand by the noted ethnologist, you know. His description of a woman who'd vanished from her dwelling one night to be found on the following morning, tied to the top of a very tall tree by fine lianas, and then afterward gliding down the tree head down, while hissing and rapidly flicking her tongue in and out like a snake. She hung there, suspended for a time, and proceeded to speak in a language that no one had ever heard. Reagan gliding like a snake when she was following Sharon. The gibberish, an attempt at an unknown language. The case of Joseph and Theobald Berner, aged 8 and 10. A description of them lying on their backs and suddenly whirling like tops with the utmost rapidity. Sounds either totally made up or greatly exaggerated, but pretty close to Reagan whirling like a dervish. There were other similarities, still other reasons for suspecting suggestion. A mention of abnormal strength and obscenity of speech, plus the accounts of possession in the Gospels, which perhaps were the basis, speculated Karras, of the curiously religious content of Reagan's ravings at the Barringer Clinic. Moreover, in the chapter there was mention of the onset of possession in stages. The first infestation consists of an attack through the victim's surroundings, noises, odors, the displacement of objects without visible cause, and the second, obsession, is a personal attack on the subject designed to instill terror through the kind of injury that a person might inflict on another through blows and kicks. The rappings, the flingings, the attacks by Captain Howdy. All right, maybe. Maybe she read it, Karras thought. But he wasn't convinced. No. No, not at all. And even Chris, she had seemed so uncertain about it. Karras walked to the window again. What's the answer, then? Genuine possession? A demon? He looked down and shook his head. Oh, come on, no way. But paranormal happenings? Sure, why not? Too many competent observers had reported them. Doctors, psychiatrists, men like you know. But the problem is, how do you interpret the phenomena?